From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. This is Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida. And welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to, as usual, thank my producer, Mr. Brian Charlson, who is actually with us this evening, so you will hear the mellifluous tones of his Boston Red Sox rooting self a little later in the broadcast. And I'd also like, as usual, to congratulate Mr. Steve Bauer for all the fine work that he does. Like to remind everyone that if you have questions or concerns about Tuesday Topics, you can get in touch with the whole team by sending an email to us at tuesdaytopics@acbradio.org. In addition, of course, I'd like to express our appreciation to George Byes of Talking Communities, without whose software this program would absolutely not happen. This evening, we get to return to the topic of ADA, but not in the way that we've been talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act over the past few weeks, when we've gotten knee-deep into the vagaries of the law and regulations themselves in order to come up with some recommendations for you about the comments we hope you all sent in to the Department of Justice. Instead, tonight, we're going to talk about putting the ADA into practice. The Americans with Disabilities Act has one title that particularly concerns us this evening, and that's Title II. And what Title II essentially does is it extends federal laws so that they require states and municipalities to take certain actions to guarantee equal treatment for people who are disabled. And essentially, the question is, how do states do what they need in order to make the Americans with Disabilities Act effective for people who are disabled? And in particular tonight, what has Massachusetts done? Well, one of the things that they've done is they've hired a good friend of mine to work in the State House, a gentleman whose name is Carl Richardson, and a gentleman who's our guest tonight on Tuesday Topics. And I'd like, if you would, Carl, for you to start out by telling us a little bit about yourself. Not so much about yourself in your current job, but rather what you did before you found yourself as the ADA czar of Massachusetts.
First of all, good evening, everybody. As Paul said, my name is Carl Richardson, and I am currently the State House ADA coordinator for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but I've had a wide and varied background. Many moons ago, when I was in college, I was actually a film major. I was not always legally blind or visually impaired. I am a guide dog user now, but I was not always legally blind, and I had aspirations of becoming a film director. And I went off to L.A. and struggled like many other people did and tried to make it in the film world. Didn't quite work out that way, but came back to Massachusetts where I originally grew up. Did a number of things. Worked for a number of years at the Museum of Science in Boston in corporate fundraising, where it was my job to help get corporations and foundations and government agencies to help underwrite some of the things we had going on at the Museum of Science. Then I worked for the Media Access Group at WGBH in marketing, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Media Access Group at WGBH for the DVS descriptive video services they provide, where they make film and television and various media more accessible to the blind and visually impaired through the use of descriptive video with MoPics and movie theaters with descriptive video on TV and formerly their descriptive video catalog. I did marketing for them. Due to downsizing, I had to leave the Media Access Group, and I kind of stumbled around for a few years looking for some work, doing a little bit of consulting here and there, but looking for some work. And then the position at the State House with the Bureau of State Office Building was posted on the on the Commonwealth Employment Opportunities website, and I applied for it. I got the interview, and I went for the interview and got the job. Now, a little bit of background about how the position came about, because those of you who are advocates might find the background interesting. The position came about as a result of a lawsuit by those in the disabled community. There was a lobbying and advocacy group called the Disability Policy Consortium, or as known here in Massachusetts, DPC. DPC had a number of individual members going to the State House to try to do simple things like attend hearings, testify in hearings, visit their legislators. A number of them were deaf, a number of them were wheelchair users, and those two particular communities in particular were having trouble accessing the legislators because, for instance, interpreters weren't always provided, or a meeting might have been held in a room where a wheelchair user had no access to. So as a result, the lawsuit was filed against the general court, and the general court in Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, is the legislature, which comprises of the House of Representatives and the Senate. It was filed directly against the legislature, not so much state agencies or other agencies, because they're really required to follow the ADA by law. The legislature is a little different, even though you don't think it would be. Attorney General Martha Coakley thought the lawsuit had some merit and did not want it to go to court. So they sat down with the Disability Policy Consortium and worked out some things. And one of the things was to create my position, the State House ADA coordinator. I work for the Bureau of State Office Building, which is an executive branch agency which basically operates and maintains a number of buildings throughout the Commonwealth, state-owned buildings. But the reason why my job, even though I'm kind of working for the legislature to make the State House more accessible, because the legislature owns the State House, they figured it would be easier if I had access to engineers, maintenance men, and people who maintain and operate the building so I could make the building more accessible. I'll quickly just give a brief definition of my job, and then I'll let Paul ask me some more questions. Basically, my role, simply put, with the Bureau is to make the programs, services, and activities more accessible to people of all abilities coming into the State House. We're trying to approach this from a cross-disability perspective, whether you're deaf, blind, visually impaired, hard of hearing, a wheelchair user, a person with a psychiatric disability, or even an elderly person who may have some of the same issues and concerns as a disabled person as they get older. We are trying to look at it from a broad perspective.
Excellent. Thanks, Carl. That's a wonderful answer. So I gather from the fact that a lawsuit was filed that at least the legislative branch wasn't doing well. Now, you work for the executive branch, and I think that your job also involves working directly with the governor's office as well. Is that right, Carl? So that you're kind of one of these people who straddles two sides of the fence, because you work for the legislature and you work for the governor's office. Is that right, sir?
Eventually, yes. My agency is part of administration and finance, which basically falls under the governor. So I do work for the governor's office in a very indirect way. But I'm really there. Even the governor in Massachusetts, the governor is considered a guest of the legislature in the State House. So while I do work for the governor, and the Bureau certainly work together collaboratively with the governor to ensure all his programs and services and activities are accessible, a lot of what I do is actually advise the legislature and work with the legislature, because most of the activities in the building are legislative-based, whether it be a hearing that someone wants to come in to testify at, or a meeting with a representative, or a tour at the State House, which is actually with the Secretary of State's office, which Brian can tell you about. He actually took part in a tour. But you're right. I'm in a unique position in the building where the work that I do is both with the legislator, the legislature, and the governor, and it's often a tricky balance.
Now, does Massachusetts have a person who is kind of in charge of the ADA in the governor's office, or how is the state as a whole, in through its other agencies, enforcing the ADA, if you know the answer to that question?
There is an office called the Mass Office on Disability, and they're supposed to help and oversee ADA coordinators within all the other executive branches throughout the Commonwealth. And, you know, that's a mixed bag. Some of them do a good job and some of them don't. But there is a procedure in process and rules in process for that.
So let's return to the role that you've taken over the past year. When you got there, since there was a lawsuit, there were obviously a number of things wrong. So tell us a little bit about some of the specific things that you actually had to fix or make better at a legislative issue or at the legislature so that people can get a better idea of the kinds of things that perhaps they need to be asking their state legislatures to do.
And I don't want to make it sound like the legislature was doing a bad job. It's just that they didn't necessarily have a person or a single place that they could go to ask for help. Since I've been there, the legislature, the general court, and I'm going to, for the purpose of this discussion moving forward, since I'm used to calling it the general court, if you don't mind, I will call the legislature the general court. The general court has been very supportive of the bill and what we're trying to accomplish. A number of things that we tried to fix immediately are simple things, or not so simple, well, what I considered simple things. For instance, we have a number of power-assisted doors in the state house so that a wheelchair user can get into the building. Well, they were not always working for a number of reasons. It could be a simple reason like maybe the 9-volt battery and the transistor going between the receiver and the door wasn't changed enough. Or maybe somebody forgot to turn on the electricity which goes to that door. So what we've done is instituted a weekly checklist to check the buttons every single week. And I get a list every Friday night before I go home on which power doors are working and which ones are not, so that I can put in a work order and get them fixed and have a track them. Before that, nobody was able to track and maintain that, so that we didn't know when the doors were working and when they were not. That sounds like a simple thing. We did the same thing with wheelchair lifts in the building where we don't have ramps. Although moving forward, the Bureau is trying to use ramps wherever possible instead of lifts, because lifts are tough to maintain. You have to maintain them. You have to keep the parts. You have to keep them oiled. People have to know how to use them. But now we maintain lifts on a regular basis. The thing we had to do is set up a system. And this is one of the things I'm actually very proud of, is set up a system. I also have a hearing loss, and I'm hard of hearing aside from being legally blind, so I have many ties to the deaf and deaf-blind community as well. And one of the things that was hard previously, there was no way really for a deaf person to come to the building to perform their civic duty, and there was no mechanism set in place for them to be able to do so. And if they came, they often came either having other agencies pay for interpreters or they had to pay for interpreters. Now with the ADA coordinator office in place, there are funds set aside, and we have developed relationships with another agency within the Commonwealth called the Mass Commission for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and we've developed a great relationship that when interpreters are either requested, and there is now a link on the General Court webpage to request an interpreter, or I will go ahead and look at all the hearings and schedules and bills that are coming up to be heard. If I think there's one that I think is particularly important to the deaf community, I will go ahead and be proactive and schedule the interpreter and then promote it to the deaf community on their community listserv, email list, and their agencies. The other thing we do is what's called, known as CART, C-A-R-T, which stands for Communication Access Real-Time Translation. And for those of you who don't know what CART is, it's essentially a monitor or a screen or a laptop or some form of display where real-time captions of text of what is actually being said in the room is displayed so folks that are hard of hearing can see it. Often hard of hearing folks don't know sign language. ASL isn't a language in itself, and hard of hearing folks may not know sign language, so CART is the way to go, and they may be more English than ASL oriented. CART can be done one of two ways. Either you can have a person in the room typing what's being said, and they type about 200 to 250, 300 words a minute with about a 98% accuracy. It's really amazing to see. And or as it's getting to be the case, because it is getting very difficult to find on-site CART providers, we're doing what is known as remote CART providers, where we provide a phone line and an internet connection with a laptop, and they listen in through the phone line and type over the internet connection, and it then gets displayed through a projector onto a screen. And as a result of the demand for CART, and as a result of a shortage of on-site CART providers, people are coming in person, we have now started wiring all the public spaces in the stay house to have both internet and phone jacks, so that if a deaf person comes in and requests CART and I can book the remote CART, we can simply plug in the necessary equipment. So that's one of the things I'm most proud of. Another simple thing is we've started to make sure the elevators ding, so that if a blind person's in the building, they know when the elevator's going up or down. They ding, forgive me, I can't remember, but I believe it dings twice if it's going down and once if it's going up. And, you know, it dings when you're inside the elevator so you know what floors you're on. We've installed large print and braille signage outside all the senators and representative offices so that people can tell what room number they're at. We have 160 representatives and 40 senators, a governor, a secretary of state, a treasurer, and the auditor all in the building with important offices to go to, and it's nice if people know where they are in the building. So those are just some of the things. We're also working on, it's important that the people, the staff, and everybody in the building know how to deal with the disabled community as they come into the building, because it's the Bureau's belief that if the people dealing with them, the frontline staff, know how to deal with them as they come into the building, it'll make a much better visit and an overall better impression. So we are in the process, it's actually been written, in the process of creating the disability awareness sensitivity training. We just have to schedule the dates and go ahead with the training. And I'll stop so that people can ask some questions. But those are just few of some of the things we've done. And the other thing that's also important is we've created a advisory, and forgive me for rambling on, I have a tendency to do this, but we've created a day house ADA advisory council made up of all the various members of the community so that they can tell me what the issues and priorities are to them and advise me and guide me on where to go and how to proceed. And Brian, who is here present tonight, is on that advisory council.
I can ask you two more questions, and then we'll open it up so that other people can get a word in edgewise here. The question that I want to ask is, it's now pretty common for legislative sessions to be carried either via cable or satellite or on the internet. And my question is, as you, in addition to the captioning that you do in the room, are you actually able to A, carry legislative sessions or committee meetings on the internet or on satellite, and B, are you able to make those accessible by providing captioning?
And I'm glad you asked that, because I actually forgot that. Previously, the general court formal sessions, and the formal sessions, by law in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I believe Massachusetts is one of only four full-time legislative bodies in the country, as far as on the state level, used to be on TV. To save money, they went to the internet. Well, that created some problems and difficulty for the deaf community, because if it was still on TV, by FCC regulation, they would have been captioned. There are really no such regulation. I mean, there are some 508 standards, but those are loosely enforced. So it went to the formal sessions are those where they actually vote on bills. The informal sessions are not broadcast, only the formal sessions, but they have sessions every 3 days. All formal sessions of both the House and Senate are broadcast over the internet. And yes, I am happy and proud to say that the Bureau and the legislator, the legislature, the general court, are working together to provide what is called open captions, meaning they're on all the time, of all the webcast. And that's another thing. The general court has also made significant strides in ensuring that their website is also accessible to the blind and visually impaired computer users. For instance, a lot of their bills before used to come out in PDF format only, and now both the House and Senate offer their bills in text and in PDF, so that if you can't access the PDF, you can access the text or alternative format version.
You've brought me to another question, because it's not a question that I've heard a good answer to. One of the things that happens with bills is when they're going through the committee process, they get marked up. That is, changes are made to those bills as they're going through the legislative process. And one of the things that we as blind people all over the country, I think, find difficult is being able to distinguish those elements of a bill which have been marked up. That is, what are the actual changes that have been made, and how can we tell what the changes are so that we can know which parts we need to look at as compared to the original bill that was introduced? If you know, because it's kind of a technical question, how does the general court deal with distinguishing markup so that folks who are blind or visually impaired can actually tell what's going on?
Paul, I'm sorry to say I don't really have a good answer for that. That's really an issue that I have not fully addressed as of now. But since you asked the question, and I'll make a note of it, I will talk to the chief information officer who does the website for the general court and ask them if there's a way that we can do that.
Excellent. And my last question, and then I will open it up, is this. What do you still need to do? Because even though you've been there for a year and have certainly made some huge strides in terms of creating more accessibility, I would assume there are still some things out there that need to be done. So what will you be working on? What are some of the new projects that you'll be moving forward with over the coming year?
One is the State House, is for those who don't know, is I believe the oldest standing State House in the country. The oldest part, the bullfinch part of the building, which is the part, it has a beautiful gold dome with actual 24-karat gold, a very thin layer on the gold dome. That foundation was laid in 1798 and completed in 1795 and put into place in 1798. And then there were different sections of the building built over the decades and even different centuries, the 1800 and even the 1900s. So, and most of those parts of those buildings were built well before the ADA even existed. And the State House, because it is owned and run by the legislature, is ADA exempt. So a lot of my biggest challenges, while I'm continuing to try to make the programs and services at the State House accessible, my biggest challenges moving forward is to find a way to keep the history and the architectural beauty of the building, but also make it fully compliant, not just compliant with the ADA. I'd like to see it, the Bureau would like to see it exceed the ADA. Unlike a lot of historical buildings that are museums now and they can get variances, the thing that makes the State House unique is that it's still a living, breathing building where people come every day to perform their civic duty. So as we move forward and redo parts of the building, the Bureau would like to get involved in the study phases, in the design phases, and work with the architects as we redo parts of the building to ensure accessibility built in ahead of time. I would also like to find a way, because one of my biggest challenges is physical barriers for those of people with mobility impairment, not just wheelchair users, but people who, elderly people who may have breathing problems, or we're looking at little things like installing benches throughout the building so that people can sit and rest. But the other thing is, I'd like to look at a way to fix the thing about lifts is they break down a lot no matter how often you maintain them. And the other thing about lifts is they're okay for manual wheelchair users, but they're not very good for power wheelchair users, because most lifts have a weight limit of how much poundage they can carry, and whether it be 450, 750, it's very easy, even for a small 100-pound lady or a 120-pound person, to exceed a 450 weight limit in a lift. And when that happens, the lift breaks down. So that makes lots of the stay house not as accessible to a wheelchair user as I would like. And the reason why the wheelchair, power wheelchairs, exceed the weight limit is because they're big, the thickness of their wheels, the battery power packs are often very heavy, the power to make those wheelchairs run, you know, and a lot of them are like big, huge recliner chairs because sometimes the people need to be comfortable and tilt back. And so there's a lot of physical issues with the building I'd like to fix over time. Because of that, the bureau's going to be there a long time. We just bought a Braille embosser, and I'd like to hook that up and start on a small-scale Braille production for the blind and visually impaired of bills and things like that that people have access to in the Massachusetts State House Library. We are currently exploring a relationship with the library. Well, they will house the embosser and be trained on how to produce Braille. There's a lot of things to do. I'm not worried about, the Bureau is not worried about, or I'm not worried about losing this job anytime soon. So we have a lot left to do.
Excellent. Thank you, sir.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Let me open it up and see if other folks have some questions for Mr. Carl Richardson, who is our guest, who is ADA coordinator for the State House, which houses the General Court in Massachusetts, which, unlike what the name implies, is actually the two chambers of the bicameral legislature in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So questions for Carl.
This is Brian, Carl. One of the things I enjoyed there recently was a tour of the building. You mentioned that it's an old building, and any old building has some interesting architecture and artworks and the like. What have you done to help gain access to the historical nature of the facility as well as the current legislative process?
The Bureau has been working closely with the Secretary of State's office to try to figure out how to make some of the tours more accessible. One of the things we did immediately was Braille out the tour card that I handed out to the sighted public to read the tour card. We've also worked, it's tricky with the Secretary of State's office because their tour guards are interns that turn over every 6 months. They're college interns. It's a non-paid position. Well, I think they get a slight stipend, but and they usually come from either Suffolk or Northeastern University or one of the local colleges. But a couple of the things we've done is, if, for instance, if there's a wheelchair user, we encourage them to think alternatively in terms of the route they may take when they give the tour. If it's a blind person, maybe they cut down a little bit on the amount of history they give in the building and go to a little more descriptive tour so that the blind person can get a feel for the building, because the building is an incredibly beautiful building with a lot of marble and murals and painting and artwork. And I'm not sure, this is going to be a challenge, I'm not sure we'll ever fully be able to get the full sense of the building, but to be more descriptive, we now have a relationship so that deaf people can take tours with interpreters. So we are trying to, and we'll, oh, the other thing is they now have rubber gloves so that there's a handful of artwork throughout the building that people can touch. Like, I believe there are some cannons and maybe some molding or on the stairway that's very intricate so you can feel it. That's an ongoing process as we get more and more experience, and as we get into the biggest challenge is working with everybody in the building to get in the frame of mind of thinking of accessibility. But the Secretary of State's office is now starting to do that with every tour, and it's an ongoing process. It's just not a one-shot thing. The other thing we're starting to think about, but it's going to take funding and a lot of study and research, is some form of audio description for the building. You know, I don't really want to get into the business of handing out devices and collecting licenses. So we're looking into whether it can be done through a cell phone and the audio be stored on a server. Or, I mean, there's a number of things, but those are just some of the things we're looking to do with the tours, make the tours more accessible.
One of the things that stands out for me is in the past year, you've increased what the legislature spends on accessibility from not a heck of a lot to quite a pretty penny, especially if you include CART for every formal session and money that's being spent on interpreting as well. Have you found that there are people within the Bureau or at the General Court who resent the amount of money that's being spent on ADA compliance? Or perhaps put another way, how do you sell what it is that you do?
The lawsuit just got settled a couple weeks ago, to be honest, even though I've been there a year. So at this point, I'm not having to do a whole lot of selling. And secondly, it was only I don't think the General Court ever meant to not make the building accessible. I just think they didn't. And I'm trying to figure out how to say this because I just don't think they knew how to go about it. And now that the Bureau and I are there, they have a resource they can go to try to figure it out. So no, at this point in time, I am not getting any resentment. As a matter of fact, I have gotten nothing but, for the most part, support and a lot of help. It's only been about 13 months. And as a matter of fact, at the end of this month, the General Court and the Disability Policy Consortium, which is the group that initially brought about this lawsuit, are getting together to have a press event with the governor, the Senate president, the Speaker of the House, and the Attorney General will do collaboratively to announce not so much the settlement of the lawsuit, because we're trying to move forward and present a uniformly positive message. Everybody say, look, this is now the people. This is now truly the people's building. Please come and celebrate accessibility. So that's what we're trying to do moving forward. And I can't wait. It should be an interesting day. So, no, yes, you're right. The amount of money has gone up quite a bit in some cases. But, for instance, the Commission for the Deaf was actually picking up some of the interpreter costs and cost for the Statehouse access because they were committed to trying to make the building accessible. It's just that since they weren't in a building, they weren't always aware of events, so they couldn't do it, but they would pay for it when it did. So instead of there being a line item in their budget to make the Statehouse accessible, it's just now a line item in the Bureau's budget. So some of the money just got transferred from different agencies who provided these services. But you're right, there certainly is an increase both in the Bureau's budget and the General Court budget. But at this point in time, the legislature, the General Court, and the Bureau look good by providing access to people of all abilities. So no, right now, everybody is happy to do it.
Would I be accurate in saying that you're probably approaching spending $1 million on access, or is it something less than that?
Considerably less, because, for instance, well, I don't know. For instance, the captioning of the formal sessions come out of the Speaker's budget, meaning the House of Representatives Speaker DeMacy's budget. I have no idea what they're paying for the captioning. That didn't come out of my budget. I do pay for CART and interpreter and my salary, but no, I don't think it's anywhere near $1 million. Well, it's interesting because the Bureau puts in a ramp in the building to a particular hallway so that a wheelchair user can go into the hallway. That doesn't come out of my budget. It comes out of the capital improvement budget. So it's kind of tricky. So I don't really have I know what the Bureau's line item for Statehouse access is. And no, that's not even close to $1 million. But I would still guess that it's not, even with some of the capital improvements that we've made, and at least not for the year, I wouldn't guess it's anywhere near $1 million. Maybe $500,000, I don't know.
Still, it gives one pause, doesn't it, though, to think that we're now spending $500,000 to make a state legislature accessible. It's actually a huge step forward and really a pretty good thing. Other questions for Carl?
I'm going to step in with another one, and that it has to do with the story, Carl, that you told me. Because I think sometimes accessibility, we get wrapped up in the idea that it's got to be an expensive thing to pull off, and that it's always you make a change to a building for a wheelchair user or a change to a process for a deaf user. Provides braille and signage for a blind user, that kind of thing. But sometimes what you do for accessibility doesn't always stay put, and you don't always necessarily get yourself strictly involved in what happens within the four walls. Can you tell the story about the garden party?
The picnic for the governor?
He can call it a picnic. I'm going to call it a garden party.
Governor, over the summer, the governor and the lieutenant governor, they have several interns that work for them over the summer. And at the end of the summer, they like to have a celebratory picnic to thank the interns for their service and their hard work throughout the course of the summer. And the picnic is out on the grass, if you're facing the front house, kind of to the left of the stay house off the west wing. There's no way for a wheelchair user to get onto the grass. So initially, somebody called me up and said, oh my God, one of my interns is a wheelchair user. What do I do? And initially, somebody else and I thought, well, maybe we ought to cancel it. But then we started thinking that wouldn't be fair because A, it would make the young intern feel bad, and B, it wouldn't be fair to the tradition and what they normally do at the stay house and thanking the intern. So we had to do some work. So the Bureau called the Mass Office on Disability to do an on-site survey of the how to get onto the grass and overgo the curb. And because I'm visually impaired, I can't measure stairs and ramps and stuff with the accuracy and the comfortability that I would like to be able to do. So we had a community person, Jeffrey Dugan, come from the Mass Office on Disability, and he took all the measurements and figured out that I'd have to basically build a 40-foot wheelchair ramp outside going up onto the grass. So once I got the measurements and what we needed, I had to find a company that would do such a thing, and it was tricky because since I'm in the executive branch, I have to use particular vendors that I have state contract. Nobody had a state contract to build temporary wheelchair ramps. So with a few days' notice, I had to find a way to do a quote. But the short story is we built a temporary 24-hour wheelchair, ADA-compliant wheelchair ramp so that the intern could go on the grass and have hamburgers and hot dog and soda and be with his peers. And that also is a very... To me, it was the first time we made an outdoor event fully accessible to a wheelchair user, and that was a very proud day also.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool when that happens. I guess I'm considered kind of a gadfly at the university or at the college where I work, and relatively soon after I came, I started insisting that it was appropriate for students in wheelchairs to be able to roll across the stage rather than being handed their diplomas in the well of the auditorium. And I can tell you this was not a popular thing at the time when I started expressing my opinion, but I'm happy to say that now I don't even have to be involved. It's taken for granted that there is going to be a ramp and that students will have access to the stage. I'm scared, though, because I'm going to have to do more work this year because we've outgrown the place where we've held our graduations in the past. But I absolutely know what you mean, and I also know what a huge difference it makes to people because so often they're told, if they're wheelchair users, well, just sit down there and we'll bring it to you. And that's not what wheelchair users want to do. They want to be as fully integrated into a process or a proceeding as they can be. So I commend you guys for doing that. I hope you kept the ramp so that the wheelchair user who's there next year can go to the picnic as well.
The temporary setup, but because we didn't have the expertise to know how to set it up. But we learned a lot from the process, and we'll be in a better position to do it next time. You know, and that was a relatively inexpensive thing. And as Brian said, it doesn't always have to be the expensive, say, captioning or the interpreters. While those are crucially important and vital, one of the cheapest things I've done, the Bureau has done, excuse me, when I say I mean the Bureau, one of the cheapest things the Bureau has done to improve accessibility, a lot of the power-assisted doors have these crash bars on the other side, and if the crash bars are not depressed and locked into place via the use of an Allen wrench, the power doors don't work. Even if a person who can pull the handle can open the door and go in manually, the power buttons don't work. And I approached, and it took me a long time to figure out why I could hear the power going to the door, but I couldn't hear the lever being released. And nobody knew the answer, and the Bureau finally figured it out. It was because people who were responsible for opening up the room were not taking a device that cost maybe $1, an Allen wrench, and turning the crash bar and engaging and locking the handle in the plate so that the button could then open and close the door. And the Bureau just purchased over 100 Allen wrenches, and we purchased them round at the end so that they could clip onto people's key ring. So now people can carry the Allen wrenches in their pocket, and when they open the doors, it'll be automatically become part of the procedure. That was not a very expensive fix at all.
Yeah, but it makes a huge difference. It really does. And as you say, it isn't always the expensive stuff. So let me ask you a harder question. I would assume that you're also the person who fields complaints about the accessibility of the general court. Have you received some complaints? And when you've gotten those complaints, are there some issues that you haven't been able to resolve? Do you think that all disabled people are reasonable, or do you think that some of the complaints are a little silly? What do you think?
I do feel the complaint, not only against the general court, but generally connected to the State House. There are executive branches in there now, and as word gets out throughout the disabled community that there is an ADA coordinator and he is accessible, I've gotten calls, and I do keep a spreadsheet where I track all the calls, and instead of complaints, I like to call them concerns. But yeah, and I do get some concerns, and I do get some people that basically all they want to do is be heard, and they just want to complain, and they just want to know that somebody's listening. 90% of the time, I get calls that are valid, but there's once in a while I get a call from a person that you know, they're angry and upset because they've had a challenge in life and they need to be heard. I would say the number one complaint I get has to do with parking. And at this point in time, because of the limited space and size of the stay house, a number of things happened to make parking difficult at the stay house. One, 9/11 happened, and that also made the building more inaccessible to the public at large, not just say, wheelchair users or the disabled community. Before 9/11, there were 23 exits, and you could basically go in all 23 exits into the state house. After 9/11, it went down to 3. Now it's down to 2, and of those 2, only one is fully handicap accessible. Also, because we had to put gates up all around the state house, that cut down on parking and things like that. And also, there is no public parking around the stay house. Only the general court parks around the stay house. You have to have an L sticker in your car, L sticker meaning legislative sticker in your car, and they get to park around the stay house. So I don't really have any parking to make available to the public in terms of handicap parking. And we do have a lot of wheelchair users or people with mobility difficulties or blind people who have handicap placards or who have difficulty and could use easier access from the building in terms of public transportation. So that is the number one complaint. And we are exploring alternatives to try to figure out how to ease that, but that's going to be a long-standing process.
Yep. parking and transportation are interesting issues, particularly when you actually don't have any direct parking, and yet at the same time you're supposed to be certain that access to the building assures an accessible path of travel, and that accessible path of travel isn't excessively long. So it makes your life interesting because some of the demands of the ADA go directly against what it's easy for you to do. Don't know if I'd like to be in your situation. So let me ask one more question since I have this thing depressed. And my one other question is, we've talked about a lot of your successes. Is there something in the last year that you've failed to do aside from the parking, which is going to be a head scratcher for a while? Is there something else that you've failed to do? Another thing that illustrates some of the problems that the ADA creates for a person in a position like yours that you so far haven't been able to solve?
Fail maybe, or not yet accomplished, because, you know, I try to learn from what happened. I haven't always been able to provide the interpreters or the cart for the deaf community when they come into the building. Sometimes there's a shortage and there's nothing you can do. The lift aren't always working when wheelchair users come into the building. Sometimes if they break the part, it takes 2 or 3 weeks. And it's not all the legislators, believe it or not, even though there's been many emails and a lot of correspondence and a lot of one-on-one meetings, still know to come to the Bureau as a resource. We haven't yet trained everybody. So, no, I mean, I wouldn't say failures, but I would say things to still work on. I'm trying to think if there's anything blatant I can share with you. The other challenge is the State House has a number of public spaces which they will rent out to outside agencies, outside corporations, as a means of raising revenue for the operations of the State House, because the building's very expensive to maintain, clean and that sort of thing, maintaining, restoration. And I think the Bureau has to do a better job of working with those outside agencies and companies that come into the building to say, wait, you know, you've got to think about accessibility as well, but at the same time maintain a distance because it's their event. So it's a tricky balance, so I have to figure out how to do that. And I still have not figured out a way to get all the assistive listening devices in the building to work with all the PA systems in the building. So that's something. So there are a number of things that the Bureau has not accomplished yet. But rather than call them failures, I'll just say that we haven't accomplished them yet, and we're looking forward to eventually accomplishing those goals.
One of the issues that sometimes operates with old buildings is creating accessible restrooms. And I know this is not exactly the most exciting of topics, but has that been an issue for you, or have you actually been able to identify a sufficiently large number of restrooms to meet your ADA obligation that you've been able to renovate so that they are accessible to folks with disabilities?
We have a handful of ADA accessible restrooms, not as many as I would like. I mean, we certainly have far more restrooms than we do accessible restrooms. And those were done actually before I came on board. So that hasn't been something that I've really had to work with. Now, moving forward, the State House is thinking about redoing significant portions of the building. And moving forward, we are looking into redoing some of the restrooms. And that's the nice thing about it. Now that there is an ADA coordinator in position, as we take on new construction projects, new architectural projects, somebody dedicated solely to accessibility can look at it with that eye. I have a bit of a reputation in the building as being single-focused and not letting go of an idea, because the engineers and the architects and the other workers in the Bureau have a much greater responsibility than I do. They have to see how their project work into the building as a whole, and where I have to look in to see how each project works in terms of accessibility. We have 4 or 5 accessible restrooms in the State House, but that's not a lot for the number of restrooms we have in the State House and the size of the building.
Well, it's a lot better than none. However, one of the things that you talked about earlier and that I'd like to clear up before we go on is you made the point that the legislature isn't obliged to comply with the ADA. Could you explain that a little more for our listeners so that they understand?
Well, I don't fully understand it myself, to tell you the truth. I didn't mean that their programs and services shouldn't necessarily comply with the ADA, because obviously they feel it has to now, or else that the Bureau and I wouldn't be doing ADA access. But the building is certainly code exempt. And traditionally, they thought that some of their hearings and things were, I think, something that only a privileged few would attend. But I don't think that when I said that it's not exempt, it's just that what I meant is within the executive branch, there are very strict rules and guidelines. The governor and the Mass Office on Disability have a number of rules, Executive Order 478 and Massachusetts Laws and Handbook, where they have to follow accessibility guidelines. And if they don't, they can get into pay some serious repercussions for that. There's no handbook or laws anywhere saying this session must be captioned. This thing must be interpreted. There aren't the same laws, even though a lot of the laws that the governor's office has and state agency has were probably put in place by the legislature for state agencies. They didn't necessarily do it for themselves. But having said that, I think now they are trying to do the right thing and move forward. So that's what I meant when they're not necessarily required by law. It's just that the laws aren't specific enough to cover the legislature the way they do the executive branch and the judiciary branch and the other branches of government.
Just to clear up a couple of things, under the ADA, when a building was constructed before the ADA came along, there are some different guidelines which operate for that building. And when a building, such as the State House, would qualify under a building suitable for historic preservation, there are also another set of guidelines which limit the amount that has to be done or that can be done to make it ADA compliant. And so it actually makes Carl's job a little harder, because he's got to play around in trying to persuade people to do things when they could actually drag their feet and say, we don't want to, and we're not going to, and you can't make us, which in some respects is actually entirely true. Brian, do you have a final question for Carl?
Just one, Carl. Is your involvement strictly with the State House, or does it extend to any of the other Bureau managed properties in the Commonwealth?
And is referring to, and he would know this because he is a taxpayer in the Commonwealth, is that the Bureau of State Office Building runs and maintains six state-owned buildings. Most of the agencies are in rented buildings, but the six, we have four buildings in Boston and one in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and one in Springfield, Massachusetts. In some ways, yes, the Bureau has started to look at extending the role of the ADA coordinator to the other five buildings. And in some ways, it is far easier because the Bureau maintains and runs those buildings. And as long as it falls in with the rules and laws, we can kind of do what we need to do. And as long as we have the budget for it, we can do what we need to do. The Bureau doesn't necessarily need to ask the permission of the legislature to put in a ramp into the building so that the wheelchair user can access the hallway. If we want to put a ramp into one of the other buildings, we'll just go ahead and do it. So, yes, the role of the ADA coordinator has started to look at the other buildings. It's fairly a new thing, but I've got a new superintendent and accessibility. Her name is Carol Cornelison, and accessibility is a very important part of what she the mission of the Bureau to be. So yes, we are starting to look at other buildings, and she also wants me to be a resource, wants the Bureau to be a resource to the agencies within the building. So if another agency has an event or has an accessibility question, they can call our office and get in touch with me and ask us, hey, Carl, I've got an event. What's the best way for me to provide an interpreter? or, hey, Carl, I have a wheelchair user trying to get to their desk. What the height clearance of the desk have to be? You know, so we are starting to expand the role a little bit.
I've always thought it would be kind of cool to make every single legislature in the state, all, in your case, all 160 of your representatives and all 40 of your senators go through ADA training. I don't suppose you've gotten there yet, but are you actually working on that, on making the legislators actually go through ADA training?
Well, we're going to start off with the frontline staff, and the frontline staff is the park rangers. And for those of you who don't know, the park rangers do the security of the state house. When you go into one of the two public entrances, you have to be, since 9/11, you have to be screened by security, much like you're going through the airport. The only difference is here, you don't have to take off your shoes. But they're going to get trained. The court officers, which are the people that work for the Sergeant of Arms office and the legislature, the general court, and they help run the formal and informal sessions of the general court as well as all the hearings. They're going to be trained, have disability training. The folks that conduct the statehouse tours, because they, an average of 90,000 visitors a year take the statehouse tours, so, and you can't tell me that a good percentage of those 90,000 people probably have disabilities, so we're going to figure out a periodic system so that they will be, and that's going to be challenging because they have a high rate of overturn because it's mostly college interns and volunteers and history buffs that do the tours, so we have to figure a system for that. So initially, just the people to deal with the frontline staff. We do foresee perhaps extending the training to legislative aide and legislative staff. I'm not quite sure the Bureau is quite ready or the General Court is quite ready to extend the training to the senators and the reps. Now, I think we'll certainly make an open invitation, but with the frontline staff that I mentioned, oh, and the state police who also work in the building will also have to attend. It will be mandatory for the folks, the park rangers and the general court, the Secretary of State Tours Division, and a handful, the library staff. It'll be more or less mandatory, and they will have to do it. Once we see, we've got to try this out. This is kind of going to be a pilot. And then we've got to see what works and what doesn't work, and then perhaps then we can have a discussion about expanding the training. We're not quite ready yet to ask the general court to participate.
Mr. Carl Richardson, we'd like to thank you very much for being a Tuesday Topics guest and for answering our questions about a very challenging and complex issue. How do you make the legislative process of a state accessible to people who are disabilities? Who are people with disabilities? That's really interesting. Who are people who are disabilities? What an intriguing concept. We could do a whole show, Brian. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. Again, our email address is TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. And I'd like to thank everyone for listening this evening. I'd also like to thank everyone for your participation. And remember, you will continue to listen to our program as long as you are people who are disabilities. Good night.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.